Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, August 10th, 2016. Donald Trump has gone even lower. This time, dog whistling to lunatics who are heavily armed. That it might be okay to assassinate his opponent, Hillary Clinton. Phil Lynott and Thin Lizzy open the podcast today. There's a killer on the loose. And Donald Trump has set in motion the kind of forces that could produce an assassination of a presidential candidate. And while some people may dismiss the reaction from allies of Hillary Clinton as overblown, I have to say that I just finished reading a powerful book about Robert F. Kennedy. And the sequence about his assassination at the Ambassador Hotel in June of 1968, it brought me to tears. And living through that era, where we lost JFK, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy in a 4.5-year period, well, it changed me as an American, and I'm sure I'm not alone. And for Donald Trump in his tortured syntax, and that tortured syntax may be the only way he wriggles out of being accused of an accomplice to attempted murder, it shows how he believes he's going to win this presidential race by connecting with the most unstable, angry, and ill-informed elements of American society. Because this whole comment was framed around his false claim that Hillary Clinton and Democrats want to abolish the Second Amendment, abolish the right to bear arms, and that she would appoint judges to achieve that goal. Now, this is so far-fetched. It's like the NRA meme that Obama is coming for your guns. And then he went on to say, if she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. And then he added, although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know. So it's not an explicit threat. And as I mentioned, the way he speaks is not normal, it is not coherent, and so it is that incoherence that may save him in this particular case. And, of course, it echoes Sharon Angle. You remember her? The radical Tea Party candidate for the U.S. Senate from Nevada in 2010. She lost to Harry Reid, but at the time she intoned that maybe there is a Second Amendment remedy to prevent Harry Reid from being elected. That was her comment. Now, to be fair, Hillary Clinton herself made a remark that was off-key and suggested a kind of macabre possibility. This was back in June of 2008, and she was still in the race, even though it was clear Barack Obama had beaten her. And when she was asked why she didn't bail out, drop out, she said, "We all remember Bobby Kennedy was assassinated in June in California." Now, hers was not threatening, but it was a bad comment to make, and she did quickly apologize for it. Of course, Trump never apologizes for anything. He just keeps, you know, doubling down, compounding his errors. It forced the Speaker of the House, who won re-election yesterday after Trump finally endorsed him. I don't think it made any difference, but Paul Ryan said, well, it sounded like a joke gone bad, but you should never joke about that. I hope he clears it up quickly. And the backpedaling is, oh, Trump was talking about the power, the electoral power of the pro-Second Amendment movement in this country. Well, if you watch the video clip, as I did several times, and many people noted that one of his supporters, a guy in a red golf shirt sitting behind Trump, was astounded when he heard the comment, and he leaned over to his wife or companion in order to express his... he wasn't outraged, but he was surprised that Trump would say that. Meanwhile, this is a murky case. What I'm about to tell you so far is almost entirely speculative. But Julian Assange has introduced the possibility of a murder in the death of a Democratic National Committee employee, a staffer named Seth Rich. And this past Sunday morning, apparently while walking home or while leaving early, the incident occurred at 4:19 a.m. This was in the Bloomingdale neighborhood of Northwest Washington, D.C. Now, robbery is pretty much ruled out. Rich was shot twice in the back, but his wallet, watch, and other personal items were not taken. WikiLeaks has offered a $20,000 reward for information leading to conviction for the murder of DNC staffer Seth Rich. And Julian Assange has, in an interview on a Dutch television station, talked around the issue a little bit, but he appears to be inferring that Seth Rich may have been the source of the leaked emails that WikiLeaks released a couple of days before the Democratic convention began. Now, I want to be fair here. I am operating here with second and third hand, maybe fourth hand information. We know that Seth Rich is dead. We know that his family is outraged at the politicization and speculation about his death. They issued a statement. Some are attempting to politicize this horrible tragedy, and they're actually causing more harm than good and impeding on the ability of law enforcement to properly do their job. And so they are asking the public to refrain from pushing unproven and harmful theories about Seth's murder. Okay, I understand that. But let's listen to Julian Assange, and this, as I say, is indirect and a little bit circular in the way he states it, but let's listen to his own words.
Miracle. American political lexicon, there's such a thing as the October surprise. The stuff that you're sitting on, is an October surprise in there? Do you even know what you're sitting on?
WikiLeaks never sits on material. Our whistleblowers go to significant efforts to get us material and often very significant risks. As a 27-year-old who works for the DNC, who was shot in the back, murdered just 2 weeks ago for unknown reasons as he was walking down the street in Washington. So
That was just a robbery, I believe, wasn't it?
No, there's no finding. So
What are you suggesting?
I'm suggesting that our sources take risks, and they become concerned to see things occurring like that.
But was he one of your sources then? I mean,
we don't comment on who our sources
but
are.
Why make the suggestion about a young guy being shot in the streets of Washington?
Because we have to understand how high the stakes are in the United States, and that our sources are, you know, our sources face serious risks. That's why they come to us, so we can protect their anonymity.
But it's quite something to suggest a murder. That's basically what you're doing.
Well, that others have suggested that. We are investigating to understand what happened in that situation with Seth Rich. I think it is a concerning situation. There's not a conclusion yet. We wouldn't be willing to state a conclusion, but we are concerned about it. And more importantly, a variety of WikiLeaks sources are concerned when that kind of thing happens.
So this is not conclusive, clearly. And he is dancing around trying to avoid disclosing who his source for the DNC leaks was. But there is the inference here, only an inference, and of course the dangling of the $20,000 reward suggests that Assange believes that this is not just a wild lead to pursue. So I will continue to watch this. I think people deserve to know that it is occurring. The corporate media tends to avoid these issues until there is some sort of a police finding or something more substantive. But this is where the story stands as of today, and that's what I can share with you up to the minute. Now, Hillary Clinton is still in deep, hot water about her emails. The release of a new batch of State Department emails that were including communications with Hillary Clinton, but they originated from her assistants, like Cheryl Mills and Huma Abedin. And one of these email exchanges really provides information about something I've been deeply concerned about. I regard the Clinton Foundation as a cesspool of money and political influence. And when Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State, and they didn't shut down this foundation, they just made promises that they were going to be honorable and transparent, and they wouldn't take money from foreign governments that Hillary Clinton was dealing with as Secretary of State. Well, they violated all of those pledges, and we know that there was contact between the staff at the Clinton Foundation and the staff of Hillary Clinton's office as the Secretary of State, and that they were communicating about what is called donor maintenance. In political campaigns, when somebody makes a big contribution, you do what is called maintenance. You want to keep them happy. What do they want? What do they want for the money that they gave? And so the exchange between Doug Band, who was the top assistant to Bill Clinton at the foundation, shows that in 2009, they tried to put a billionaire donor in touch with the U.S. ambassador to Lebanon. In another email, the foundation appeared to push aides to Mrs. Clinton to help find a job for somebody who worked at the foundation. But the most significant was in April of 2009, Doug Band, who led the Clinton Global Initiative, emailed Huma Abedin and Cheryl Mills to ask for help with a donor. He said he needed to connect Gilbert Shaguri, a Lebanese-Nigerian billionaire who was one of the foundation's top donors, with someone at the State Department to talk about his interests in Lebanon. Now, it's not known if those are business interests, political or military, or maybe a combination of them. So Huma Abedin replied, saying, "Oh, the ambassador is Jeffrey Feltman. I'm sure he knows him. I'll talk to Jeff." And Band responded, "This is very important." In a separate thread, Band passed along to Abedin and Mills a request for a favor from an associate who'd recently been on a Clinton Foundation trip to Haiti and was seeking work at the State Department. There's also another case of a donor to the Clinton Foundation who won a seat on a State Department panel related to security issues where he had no experience. And so I've been concerned that this intersection of politics and money that is outside of the government, beyond the reach of the administration, that this could blow up and cause serious problems. And last year, I shared with you the email exchanges between Sidney Blumenthal and Hillary Clinton related to Libya, where Blumenthal was trying to cash in on the change of the guard in Libya and get some consulting contracts with a CIA buddy of his named Tyler Drumheller. There's also the case exposed in these emails of a former Ambassador Joe Wilson, who, with his wife Valerie Plame, starred in a TV commercial for the Clinton campaign in 2008. Then when she got to the State Department, Joe Wilson was lobbying her on behalf of a client who paid him to win a grant of over $60 million, which was provided, and they built a power plant in Tanzania. Hillary went to the ribbon cutting for that event. So this is perhaps the tip of the iceberg, but I've been concerned about these issues for some time now. And if Bernie Sanders hadn't thrown in the towel on those damn emails, we might have heard more about it by now, and it might have made a difference in the primaries. So the latest, too, is that the International Business Times is reporting that its requests for disclosure of correspondence between Hillary Clinton and the negotiators for the Trans-Pacific Partnership be made public. And it was on track to be released in April. But suddenly, David Sirota, who is a senior editor over at International Business Times, was notified that the search process has been completed, The search results are being prepared for the review process, and the new completion date is November 31st, 2016. So we're not going to see Hillary's involvement in the super-secret negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Partnership until after the election. Now, she says that she is against the TPP, but the Obama White House is determined to ram it through in the lame duck session after the November election. I think that this is highly relevant information that should be made public, and I see gamesmanship on the part of the highly transparent Obama administration trying to maintain this secret. Just for a little fun, I want to let you know that all of our hand-wringing over Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton may be unnecessary. Now, it's possible that Republicans will persuade the Donald to stand down, and they'll find somebody else, Mike Pence, Ted Cruz, to be their candidate in November. If that happens, I want to trade in Hillary Clinton. But I don't think I'll be given that opportunity. At any rate, did you know there are like 1,100 people who have filed to run for president this year, and one of them is an independent candidate named Andrew D. Basiago, B-A-S-I-A-G-O, Basiago, let's say it that way. And I got a press release by email today that Basiago has named his chief of staff as his vice presidential running mate, and the reason we should take note is that he is an American chrononaut. That's spelled C-H-R-O-N-O-N-A-U-T. It's like astronaut and chrono. Chrono refers to time. Well, he claims to have been an experienced time traveler. He says he has also explored Mars. I'm not sure how. He claims to have an IQ of 168. And this is his writing, career CIA officers associated with DARPA's secret time travel program confirmed that U.S. government secret time travel pre-identified this guy, what is his name again? Basiago, as a future American president, as time travel did for George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. Can you believe that? Every day I like to pause for a minute and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your generous subscriptions. People like Dick Attlee, the retired university professor. Mark Brodsky's been on board for ages. Also Jason Spitzer and Jeffrey Stewart. They're all monthly subscribers, and may I ask why you're not? Come on over, peterbcollins.com. Click on the menu button. When it pulls down, click on Become a Subscriber. You get choices on the sign-up page. $5, $10, $20 a month. Our $50 annual subscription can earn you a bonus gift. The books are displayed right there on the sign-up page. It's as easy as pie, and I hope that you will take that opportunity and help support my work. I very much appreciated it. Today, we have released a new NewsBud interview. This one is with James Bamford. And Jim Bamford has written three books about the NSA. He is an acknowledged expert on our intelligence and surveillance communities. And I caught up with Jim and talked with him about the WikiLeaks leaks versus the Russian hacks. We also talked about the big picture of America's dominance of cyber warfare, and that we have the biggest and perhaps most successful offensive cyber war apparatus in the world.
Well, you know, there's never been in the history of the world anybody with more power in terms of both intelligence and the ability to launch a sophisticated cyber war than the new head of both NSA and Cyber Command. It's basically a joint command run by the same person, Admiral Rogers. So it's an enormous amount of power. For years, he's had the power to eavesdrop on everybody. Now he has also the power to launch a war. And the U.S. is the only country so far that's actually launched a real cyber war. Cyber war being where you're actually destroying physical objects as opposed to just zeroing out a computer, which is what we did in Iran. We destroyed thousands of centrifuges. So we've entered this new world, and we now have a cyber command, which below it has a cyber army, a cyber navy, a cyber air force, and a cyber marine corps.
You can hear the full interview. It's a video with James Bamford. I've linked to it in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. And you can also find it over at NewsBud's temporary home, boilingfrogspost.com. Well, we finally have a report by the U.S. Justice Department on the police department in Baltimore. And for many people, the series The Wire is your window into crime and law enforcement in Baltimore. Now, the city is 63% black, and 91% of people arrested for discretionary offenses like failure to obey or trespassing are African American. Blacks make up 60% of Baltimore's drivers, but they account for 82% of traffic stops. And of the 410 pedestrians who were stopped at least 10 times in the 5.5 years of data reviewed, 95% were black. So this is an ongoing and serious issue. It is not limited to Baltimore. I think that this is one of the reasons that Martin O'Malley didn't get much traction in running in the Democratic primaries over the past year. But until we address these serious issues of racial profiling, of the clear abuse and harassment of minorities by police departments, even in minority-dominant communities, and until we have good cops who will turn in the bad cops, we will continue to confront these ugly issues. A group of more than 40 documentary filmmakers, including 8 who have won Oscars, has called on the U.S. Justice Department to investigate the harassment and targeting of citizen journalists who record episodes of police violence, noting that the citizens who filmed the deaths of Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, Freddie Gray, and Eric Garner were all subsequently arrested. The filmmakers wrote in an open letter that it is vital we defend the rights of these individuals to use video as a means of criticizing unjust police activity. And I consider this to be a very important issue that's been simmering for a long time. I can't summon it, but there is a guy with a website in Miami. He is a former newspaper photographer who has been repeatedly harassed and arrested for taking pictures. That's his job. And this is an issue that has been developing into this pattern for some time. So, just the details here. After Alton Sterling was shot by Baton Rouge cops during a struggle, the two men who posted the video were both subsequently detained by police. And a guy who didn't record it but was one of the people to post it was one of those who was arrested and shackled the day after he posted that video. And then the proprietor of the convenience store where Sterling was killed on the 5th of July was detained for 4 hours in the back of a police car. Diamond Lavish Reynolds, the fiancée of Philando Castile, who was killed by an officer during that traffic stop in Minnesota, well, she was held overnight by police for questioning. So this is a pattern where there are some jurisdictions where it is, I don't think this is constitutional, but they have local regulations that say you can't videotape the police. But I think this is a fundamental constitutional right, and I'm glad that filmmakers like Alex Gibney and Laura Poitras are standing up for those who whip out their cameras and capture wrongdoing. Daniel Ellsberg is speaking up for Chelsea Manning. He's joined the calls for her to face no charges or punishment related to her suicide attempt in jail in July. And it's really stunning that the military would do this. She's being investigated on multiple charges stemming from that suicide attempt, and if convicted, she could be placed in solitary or subjected to other punishment. And Ellsberg said these new charges seem designed to cause her to break down, basically to break her down as a human being. And I'm glad to see Dan stand up and speak to this issue. I reported it last week, and it is appalling. There's a petition that's been gathered more than 115,000 signatures, and it was delivered to the government today. And Ellsberg said, I want to see more Chelsea Mannings. Obviously, the government wants the opposite. Now, there are, of course, differences in each of these situations, but there's no essential difference between what she did and what I did. So the military is considering charging Chelsea Manning with resisting the force cell move team, having prohibited property, and conduct which threatens. It's absurd. And, of course, we know that Obama won't do it, but he should pardon Chelsea Manning before he leaves office. So yesterday there was a photo op in St. Petersburg where Turkish President Erdogan cozied up with the man who he'd like to copy as a strongman, Vladimir Putin. And they have mended fences following Turkey's shootdown of a Russian jet in Syria last November. They're resuming commercial relations with a natural gas pipeline and a Russia plan to build Turkey's first nuclear power plant. And what I'm curious about is if this could somehow change the dynamics of the war in Syria. Because Putin supports Assad in Damascus, and the Turks and Erdogan have made it clear they want him out. And so if they can find some common ground, I'm just speculating here, I don't have anything else to go on, it could change the dynamics there in a way that we can't predict or see from this vantage point. But in the day following, we see events confronting each of these leaders. Today, there was an attack attributed to the Kurdish group, the PKK, in southeast Turkey. A handful of people were killed. And Putin is dealing with incidents in Crimea, where he is blaming the Kiev government, the Ukrainians, for plotting terrorist attacks in Crimea, where two Russian servicemen were killed in clashes in the past week. So Putin is warning that Russia will not ignore the incidents, and we don't have any specific threats of what he might do, but he is criticizing the Kiev government and claiming that they are operating in a provocative manner. This report from Vice News raised some eyebrows with me. I have thought that there were Russian ground troops in Syria, but the Russians deny it. They say they only have aerial assets there. Now, let's be clear. The United States has commandos and proxy forces that we rent. We have mercenaries on the ground. So do the Saudis. So do the Emirates. There are hundreds of these armed groups in Syria who get paid by outsiders to keep fighting either against Assad or against the Islamic State or both. So based on the testimony of a Russian man who says he was recruited by a private military company called Wagner to go to Syria and fight for about $4,000 a month. Now, this guy survived, and when he returned, he was frustrated because they had taken all of his identification materials from him before he left, and they wouldn't give him back. Instead, he was arrested and told that Wagner does not exist. Along with another former fighter, the man who is tagged as Dmitry, said that about 500 to 600 Russians have died in Syria when the official Russian casualty count is 19. So that suggests that, there are more Russian fighters and including mercenaries on the ground in Syria. Now, the latest update in the lame duck mission creep of Barack Obama here in 2016. We are told that pro-government Libyan militias backed by the United States and numerous drone strikes have seized the Islamic State's last stronghold in Libya, the seaside city of Sirte. Now, this is not yet confirmed, but if so, it's a severe blow to the expansion into North Africa by the Islamic State. In a statement broadcast on Misurata TV, the spokesman for the attacking militia force said that the Ouagadougou Center and a nearby hospital had been captured. And that was a fortress of Muammar Gaddafi back in the day. Over the last 10 days, the militias have been supported by heavy American airstrikes using drones based in Jordan. We've conducted 28 airstrikes in the past week over Sirte, And we still don't know who these Libyan militias are and to what extent they are controlled by the United States. A couple of items from here in California as we wrap up today. The embattled chancellor of the University of California, Davis, has finally quit. Linda K.P. Katehi, who is a professor of engineering and has many patents. She was accomplished before she became chancellor. She presided over the university when that pepper spray incident occurred and became infamous. They pepper sprayed these Occupy protesters who were unarmed and unthreatening, and it really went viral. And one of the things that got Linda Katehi in trouble was she spent university money trying to scrub the internet of references to the UC Davis pepper spray incident. And so she also was accused of nepotism. A report cleared her of that. But the boss of the university system, Janet Napolitano, said that there were numerous instances where the chancellor was not candid, either with me or the press, and that she exercised poor judgment. So she has resigned. The jury returned a guilty verdict on 6 felony charges against California's rogue utility, Pacific Gas and Electric Company. This is for the 2010 gas pipeline explosion in the town of San Bruno that killed a number of people and blew up about 35 homes. And this is really frustrating because the federal prosecutors won a guilty verdict. But they appear to have screwed up so badly on the penalties because the judge informed them that a formula they were attempting to use that would have amounted to fines of over $500 million was based on state law and was not applicable in a federal case like this. And so PG&E is going to pay a fine of somewhere around $5 or $6 million instead of $562 million. And I don't know who fucked that up in the prosecutor's office, but we deserve to know. And finally, I want to applaud the work of a former Peter B. Collins producer. Joshua Emerson Smith worked for me about 7 or 8 years ago producing my daily syndicated radio show and answering the caller lines. He went on to work at public radio in Alaska, and he's now a reporter for the San Diego Union-Tribune. And I'm linking to his great story today, which is about the surviving California condors. This is a population of rare birds that was virtually extinct a few years ago, and the population has been revived. There are now more than 400 of these condors in the world. The population had declined to about 24 back in the 1980s. That's the good news. But those that were placed along the Pacific coast are showing up with serious problems caused by human activity. The coastal birds have elevated levels of PCBs. They also have been exposed to the pesticide residue DDE, which is a form of DDT. And so they are not reproducing. Their eggs are not as robust as they should be. So there is concern among scientists that these beautiful birds that weigh about 25 pounds and have a 10-foot wingspan may go into decline once again. So I encourage you to read this story. It's pretty interesting, and I'm very proud that it came from Joshua Emerson Smith. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment. You're free to share this podcast far and wide, and I'll be much obliged if you do. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.